Coming up next on Is It Just Speculation? Were you hesitant to put a name to it, even though Spoonie, like you said, isn't really the preferred name that you would like, but to kind of name it, do you think that made it more real for you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know that it really made it more real for me. I think it helped me maybe bond or make connections with other people in the community. I prefer the term like warrior. So this is the other term that's fewer people use, but it still uses like a chronic pain or chronic illness warrior, because you're like always fighting.
Hey everyone, it's Chris, the host of Is It Just Speculation, the podcast where we take a look at the gray areas of life, where things are not always black and white or as they appear to be. Today, we actually talked to Kelsey Harris, a registered clinical counselor. She has a chronic illness and she specializes in treating people with chronic illnesses due to her unique perspective. I hope you all enjoy the episode. Stick around to the end. And as always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out. Hi, Kelsey.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm good.
Awesome. So first of all, thank you for joining, because I've been looking forward to talking to you for a while now. So I appreciate you being on.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
So before we like really get started, who are you and what do you do for everybody that's going to be listening?
Yeah, so my name is Kelsey Harris. I am a registered clinical counselor in British Columbia, Canada. I'm a person with lived experience with chronic illness and chronic pain. And that's also who I specialize my work with. So, I help people with their mental health when they have chronic illness and chronic pain.
Awesome. So one of the things that I first saw whenever I, kind of found you is this term Spoonie. What is a Spoonie?
Yeah. So, I can't remember who, but it's been around for a while, and it is like a metaphor for how much energy a person with chronic illness or chronic pain has. So you start off your day with X amount of spoons. So let's say it's 10 spoons. And every time you do something, you literally lose a spoon. So you've lost some energy until you're out. And then you really can't do anything else. And it's a phrase that a lot of people with chronic illness use. It's actually not my favorite term, but it's definitely one I use because there's such a big movement within the chronic illness community of liking that phrase, because it does really explain what it's like.
Yeah. And I guess for like a comparison for some people, they might've come across on social media, like one of those things where you pick your team and you only have $10 to choose, and like different things are different amounts that you have to spend. I feel like it's kind of a similar thing for people that maybe can't visualize the spoon part of it. Maybe you have $10 totally, and you can only spend a certain amount, you know?
Yeah, it's totally like that. Yeah, it's exactly like if you do one task, you might be using two of your spoons or like two of your dollars, right? Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people can relate to that, just like on like a real base level, like maybe you wake up and you're feeling sick, but you know you have to take the kids to school, or you have to make dinner, you have to clean up the house, but you can only do so much because you're sick. I feel like it's kind of that, but you know, to a more extreme level in your case and other people's cases. Were you hesitant to put a name to it, even though Spoonie, like you said, isn't really the preferred name that you would like, but to kind of name it, do you think that made it more real for you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know that it really made it more real for me. I think it helped me maybe bond or make connections with other people in the community. I prefer the term like warrior. So this is the other term that's fewer people use, but it still uses like a chronic pain or chronic illness warrior, because you're like always fighting.
So when did your chronic pain and your health struggles begin? Like how recent was all this?
Yeah. So back in 2015, I moved from Winnipeg, Canada, which is center of the country, a smaller city, to Toronto, which is a much bigger city. And I was married at the time, and about a month and a half, 2 months in, we just decided to separate. And about a month after that, I started to notice that I was having some pain kind of in my hips. And then it kind of spread over the next 6 months or so to a lot of different regions. So that was, a fair amount of my body was in pain. And I was also noticing that I was really tired. So I had a lot of fatigue, and that relationship had ended, and I was starting a new relationship, and that person said, maybe you should go to the doctor. And I also got flagged at work for missing too many days. And so, because we only had like 10 sick days for the year, and I used them all in 6 months. So I went to the doctor. The doctor was like, "Oh, I think you have gout because my one urine test was spiking in that area, and all the other blood tests he said came back fine." So I was like, "Okay." So he gives me gout medication. I take it. Doesn't get better. My new partner had ended up breaking their ankle, and so we went to the ER, and so we were there anyway. I was like, "You know what? I'm just gonna see if I can get checked out by a doctor, right?" So the ER doctor was actually fantastic, and he did a physical exam and ran some blood tests and just to rule out things like Lyme disease. And he said, "You know what? I don't know what it is, but it sounds rheumatological in nature. So, or I'm gonna refer you to the rheumatologist here." And about Oh, that referral went through pretty fast. Maybe like a month or so later, I was in to see the rheumatologist. She ran a ton more tests. And a couple weeks after that, she's like, "I think that maybe you have lupus. Like it looks like you have some of the presentation. You have one of your blood tests flagged really high. And I think that's what it is." And then a few months later, she's like, "I think you also have fibromyalgia because some of your pain is not in your joints, it's in your muscles." And then about a year later, she's like, "You know what? You've never developed more lupus symptoms, so I'm just going to call it undifferentiated connective tissue disease," which is like it's a di diagnosis that people get when they have a presentation that's like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, but you don't have enough symptoms to warrant a full diagnosis. And so that's kind of where we landed. So I've had chronic pain basically since 2015.
So when you were going through this process, what was it like to get those misdiagnoses and maybe start, like if you hear it from a doctor that you have gout or lupus or fibromyalgia in these different time periods that you went, you kind of think, okay, that I'm going to try to do that treatment for that specific thing. Was it kind of frustrating for you to maybe go through each one and try to fix that specific thing only to find out that it's really neither of those things?
It definitely was a bit frustrating. I think the gout misdiagnosis was the most frustrating because I think that what I have could have been maybe caught earlier. So the high uric acid level apparently can just happen. Like some people just have a higher level anyway, and it doesn't mean anything. And I get it from a primary care physician viewpoint. They only know what they know, and they know a little bit about everything rather than a lot about one thing. So misdiagnoses happen. I totally get it. I was a little frustrated because I was like, "Oh man, like I'll have to go back and find another doctor and get something from that." But and then it was interesting when I told my rheumatologist that I had been diagnosed with gout. She laughed. She's like, "Do you still get your period?" And I was like, "Yes." And she's like, "Well, then you can't have gout because women only get gout if they don't have their period." So I was like, "Oh, well, that's interesting news." So I was like, "Yeah, that." And so that kind of made me frustrated. I'm like, "Okay, like my doctor really could have not diagnosed me with that because it's not possible."
Yeah, I feel like that's definitely a big thing to miss when you're kind of going in for something and they, immediately don't check that thing. So for sure, frustrating.
And then the lupus versus UCTD diagnosis. I mean, I don't find it as frustrating because they are very similar. About 30% of people with a UCTD eventually do develop lupus. So it's not or rheumatoid arthritis. So it's not a crazy like it's not like it's a huge gap between those. And then actually, I attended as a professional. I attended a World Pain Summit back in October, and they had some rheumatologists presenting, and they were saying that the classification criteria for diagnosing patients is really meant only for research purposes. And if a patient presents in a way that makes you think that they have something, they probably have that thing. So in other words, if a patient presents with lupus, but they don't quite have enough to meet that threshold, they probably still have it. So it kind of warrants like these UCTD type diagnoses kind of irrelevant because it's still more likely like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis.
Is the healthcare system where you're at for those type of things pretty good? Because I know in the States it can be pretty costly and there's a lot of red tape to go through. Is it kind of the same thing where you're at?
No, it's actually really great. So I'm in Canada and we have, first of all, we have free healthcare. So I can go to the hospital, I can see a specialist, I can go to my GP, anything like that. It's totally free, which is great. Sometimes people complain about wait times, and sometimes that is very true. We do have to wait longer. I at one point had to wait a year for an MRI, which is really crazy. But to see a specialist, so I'm now living in Vancouver, so I've moved from Toronto, and I was a little bit worried about how long it would take me to get into a rheumatologist again. But my new family doctor made the referral on February 7th, and my appointment with my rheumatologist is March 31st. So it was less than 2 months, and I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's awesome. I feel like there's definitely some pros and cons to it, but I was excited to kind of see your perspective on, your healthcare in your area, because I think that's one thing that a lot of people here that I know that have those, chronic illnesses, they really don't have any way to cover all the costs, and so they more or less just kind of ride it out, even though there's no, it's not going to improve if they don't do anything, but they don't have a choice to actually go and get anything done.
Yeah, the only thing that we don't have covered under our universal healthcare are things are like that, those extra things. So like going to a physiotherapist, or I think in the States you guys call it physical therapist, right? Or going to the chiropractor, or prescriptions aren't covered. So we do need to have like extra health insurance for those things, which isn't cheap to have. If you have a if it's covered in your under your work, that's the kind of the best. And I had really good benefits, and before I moved to mental health when I was working in retail, actually amazing benefits that covered all that stuff. And now I'm struggling a little bit more to find a good benefits package to help me out. But so that there is a bit of the financial concern there, but it's definitely a lot less here than it is in the States. I know that.
Yeah, and you brought up a interesting point about, chiropractic and acupuncture, that kind of stuff. Did alternate treatments play a role for you whenever you started getting these diagnoses? Is it common for people to, and where you're at, to basically try different things that maybe aren't known to cure anything, but maybe can help with the symptoms, like massages, chiropractic, acupuncture, and those type of maybe non-traditional treatments?
Yeah, so I'm a huge advocate for those things. When shortly after my fibromyalgia diagnosis, my rheumatologist said to me, she's like, I think like a lot of my patients go to see a physiotherapist, and a lot of my patients go see a naturopath, and maybe you should check those things out to help you manage your symptoms. And I was shocked. I'm still shocked that a specialist told me that, because that's so not common. So I did. I went. I actually found a multidisciplinary health clinic to go to that had a massage therapist, physiotherapist, chiropractor, a naturopathic doctor, and a psychotherapist, all in the same clinic. So I was like, I want to see everybody. Like, let's help me out here. And I found all of those things to be really beneficial. And some of them I've gone more often than others, but they all do a little bit something different that really has kind of helped me overall.
Awesome. Yeah, I feel like, if you have a chronic illness where maybe there's no cure, no, real improvement that you can get from like medicine, I feel like why not try those things? But to, especially like you said, to hear a specialist kind of point you to those things is a really good thing, because I feel like at least here that maybe wouldn't happen as easily, because it's, I feel like it's more of like a keep it inside the actual, medicine, and don't push anybody to the, non-traditional methods. So I'm glad that you were able to be at least sent over to see if it would help you. And it, it seems like it maybe helped you a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, Western medicine's really great for certain things, like getting prescriptions. Like if you have a chronic illness, you do need to take medication. I really do believe that, to help control certain symptoms. But for things like pain, I actually think that the non-Western medicine, so like more of that non-traditional medicine, is more helpful. Like pain medications only do so much. And there are lots of downsides to pain medications. I was on a pain medication at one point that really destroyed my stomach. So then I was having all these stomach problems, like gastrointestinal issues on top of other all my other problems. And I was like, this is terrible. So my rheumatologist took me off that one and put me on a different one. And certain pain medications can become addictive. So I think there's a lot of, you have to be kind of wary of what you're taking and how much you're taking.
Yeah.
And versus, you know, going to go to get acupuncture, getting a chiropractic adjustment, or, you know, learning psychotherapeutic methods to kind of manage your pain is just so much more beneficial, I think, long term.
So can you walk us through your personal experience over the last 7 years or so when you've been, you know, more or less navigating this new life? And did it ever stop becoming like a new life and now it's just like your normal routine? Because I mean, how much is really changing now that it's been, you know, about 7 years?
Yeah. So, you know, initially I really, really struggled, obviously physically, but like emotionally as well. I had a lot of anxiety and kind of at the time I didn't really pinpoint depression, but like looking back, I'm like, oh, I think I might have been a bit depressed as well, yeah. Which is totally normal, right? Like I would expect that to happen to anybody because we just, it is such a new life that you're having, you know, you're limited in what you can do and you're trying to navigate your friendships and family relationships and romantic relationships with all of this. And I found dating to be particularly difficult. I was, I was in a relationship, dating someone kind of early on in my diagnosis, and that relationship really didn't work out for multiple reasons, but definitely part of it was that I was very anxious and struggling. And then kind of post that, I dated a lot, but I found it awkward of like, what do I tell people? When do I tell people?
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's so many aspects to that. And I guess for me, what really helped me most was just kind of trying to do like this personal growth journey while I was figuring out the physical health. So I kind of did both at once, to the point where, yeah, like it doesn't feel like a new life anymore. It is just, I can very easily manage my symptoms. I don't struggle with my mental health. I mean, everybody does to a degree, right? We all have our days, but you know, I certainly don't to the point I was before. But it really was that kind of this personal growth where I was like, you know what, there's things that I don't like that are happening. Part of that was like, I was really shy and I was like, I really want to be more outgoing. And I don't know why this was, but I was just like, you know, I don't think like, I really think I had some social anxiety growing up. And I was like, I really just don't want that anymore. And so I started listening to like self-help podcasts and, you know, reading self-help books in on top of going to therapy and doing all the physical health stuff. So eventually I started going to the gym and working with a personal trainer, right? Like I did all of these things to help my physical and mental health. And at the same time, I was like kind of changing into this more open, authentic, outgoing person that I think that whole change together is really what gave me kind of helped me get to where I am today.
That's awesome. You know, during that time you mentioned it kind of affected your relationships. How did it affect your relationships within your own family? Because, you know, dating is, of course, one thing. It's awkward even without illnesses. So how did it affect you and your family and even your work? You mentioned you ran out of sick days pretty early on.
Yeah. Okay. So family-wise, you know what? My family's great. I'm very lucky to have a very supportive, amazing family. I'm very close with my parents and my siblings. So overall, I would say it didn't affect too much. What really affected it is that I was really concerned with other people being concerned about me. Like I didn't like that. And I still don't to an extent. Like I don't want my mom to fret about, you know, how I'm feeling. So I kind of have always limited, I guess, how much information I give. I definitely want to make sure that they know enough, right? So that if I need them, they're there to help me. But I never wanted to like worry them. So I guess that's kind of the difficult part for me navigating that. But overall, I would say like it didn't affect my family relationships too much. And then work-wise, it was interesting. Yeah, so I was working in retail I only went back to school, and I worked full time while I went back to school, in 2019. So, so I was for those first 4 years, I was just working, and I did run out of sick days. When I got my diagnosis, I asked my rheumatologist to give me a doctor's note for work, just saying that, I have a medical condition that is going to, I'm going to take more than the allotted sick days in a year, most likely. And so she wrote me this note. I gave it to my HR manager for the comp for yeah, the region for the company. And she put in my file, and then they basically didn't even bug me about it until like 4 years later. They're like, we probably could use an updated doctor's note. So I was like, all right, sure. I mean, like, it's a chronic condition, it's not going away, but I can give you that. So I mean, I did definitely miss more than 10 sick days a year. I would say I probably took closer to the 20. And just retail being like on your feet, and the I did some sales, but I also did some like merchandising inventory, which is obviously a bit more physical. So that kind of, navigating what how many breaks to take. And I always kept my general managers in the loop so that they could support me. And I know a lot of people really struggle with that. Like, do I tell work? What do I tell work? Will they, hate me if I can't do things or need modifications? But I actually found that it was really helpful to just be like, you know what, like I might need that extra 15-minute break today because I'm not feeling super great. So I'm like, I think that's really important to keep those lines of communication open with work if you're able to.
Yeah, and I feel like this is a good time to bring in a question from Jennifer, who had a question that's how do you or how do you advise others, especially your clients, who have invisible illnesses that to everybody else you appear normal, normal and healthy, but internally you're chronically ill and in pain. How do you manage that? Because especially related to work, they might see you missing, 20 days, 10 days, however many, but they don't see that you're actually sick. They just hear that you don't feel good or you're hurting. How do you actually manage those invisible illnesses?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hard to find the balance. I think that it really depends on who you're communicating with. So, like I said, at work, I was pretty open with my general manager and HR manager, right? Because I thought that they should know, because they could support me. Colleagues wise, as I would develop relationships with people, if I felt comfortable telling them, I would just tell them, right? Like, again, like I think that a lot more people will be supportive of you than you think will be supportive of you. Especially for people who maybe don't have great support systems at home, because that's pretty common where, your family or a partner or sometimes even friends don't really understand. And sometimes you can look for support elsewhere. And sometimes that actually can come from work. And even in those family and friendship relationships, yes, some people are honestly gonna suck and just, they're not gonna get it and they're not gonna want to get it. And we really can't change other people's behavior. We can't change their thoughts and their feelings. We kind of have to just utilize our own resilience to seek out support elsewhere. And, at the same time, I think that if you're comfortable communicating with people and telling them what you need, at least giving them that chance, that can also be really helpful. My greatest story for invisible illness though is like being on the subway in Toronto. And I was like, I went on one day and I was like not feeling super great, but it was packed. And I was like, so I was standing and I was like, oh, like this sucks. Because if I was like visibly disabled, someone would have given me their seat, right? And I was like, and I'm like, yeah, I could ask someone and explain, but like that's awkward. Like no one's gonna do that. So, and then I saw later on people have actually made like stickers and stuff you can put on your jacket that say, I have an invisible illness. Please offer me your seat. Which I think is awesome, and totally a great option. But you're gonna run into those kind of difficulties. And I guess for me, I've just found it easiest just to be like, you know what, this is really interesting. I never thought I'd have to encounter something like this. And this is not like an everyday thing where I'm always standing on the subway. So, maybe it's okay for the day. And when I get home, I'll take a bath or something.
Yeah, and I've been guilty of assuming that somebody who doesn't look sick is not sick. And I think a lot of people early on would probably have the same feeling. For me, it was whenever I was young, of course, you always go to the store and see somebody take the handicap parking and they're driving a sports car, they get out and they walk just fine. And you're like, well, you know, why? Like, you're not handicapped, there's not a wheelchair, like, you don't have crutches. But once you get older and you realize that there's other types of like medical issues, and it's not just, you know, the guy in the wheelchair, like the sticker shows, then you kind of have a better understanding of those invisible illnesses overall. Did you ever have like those kind of feelings when you were maybe not sick?
You know what? Yeah, probably. I don't really remember really overthinking that, but I definitely remember reading stories like always about, you know, people with different illnesses, like MS, for example, where they often do get those handicap parking but most of the time you can't tell, right? So I think that is like a big issue that comes up for a lot of people, especially, yeah, I say especially with the handicap stickers more than anything, or like you hear stories like people yelling at other people for having, like they, you know, it's actually really hard to get a handicap placard. Like they don't just hand those out. Like your doctor really has to believe that you need it in order to get it.
Yeah, and I feel like for the people that I know that have like those chronic types of illnesses that you can't see visually, a lot of their story has been really fighting with the doctors and with the specialists to actually like confirm that they have those illnesses to that certain degree that they need the handicap. Whether that's getting on disability or, you know, trying to get benefits from the government, like it has to be proven, you know, to a certain extent to where you have to go through all those hoops and that red tape before you actually get that, you know, accommodation. So I hope your, you know, process was a little bit easier in that regard, but I feel like a lot of people I know really struggle just to prove that they're sick.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much the same here. And you hear a lot about like medical gaslighting, which I have been pretty lucky in that I haven't really encountered that. But I do hear tons of stories from clients of mine, from online, you know, people encounter like these doctors saying, even if they do diagnose them with something like, yeah, are you sick enough to go on disability? Are you sick enough to, you know, need a handicap spot? Or but even sometimes just getting the diagnosis, like on average, the reports vary, but it's like between 4 and 8 years to get a diagnosis if you have a chronic illness, which is insane.
Yeah, that's a long time to wait. And one of the questions I had were was if you were already in the mental health field before you started getting sick, or did you you know, after getting sick, get motivated to go into that field and specialize in helping people with chronic illnesses.
Yeah, so it was after I got sick. So I was working in retail and I was working in film actually. So retail was how I supported myself while I worked in film. because I've been going to all of these different healthcare practitioners, including a psychotherapist, I kind of realized as I got better that I was like, I really want to help people feel better, like feel better emotionally. When you feel better emotionally, you tend to feel better physically, and vice versa. So, I decided, yeah, to go back to school. I was really, really inspired, and I went back knowing that I wanted to work with people like me, basically.
Yeah, I think that's awesome that you kind of jumped in there and went to help those specific people that you know that you went through the same struggle with. As you were training and learning how to do this in the mental health field, did it help you manage your own changes?
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. So at first, you know, the first couple of courses you take in your master's are really like theory based. So at first I was like, okay, this is like really interesting stuff to learn, but it wasn't really helping me like other than giving me lots of knowledge. But eventually you do, you know, learn different skills and techniques that you can use with people. And I found it really interesting to try to apply those to myself. And some of them were things that I had done already in therapy with a therapist, right? Definitely some overlap there, and then some stuff was new. And when I got into my practicum, some of the final, you know, 8 months of my schooling, and one of my supervisors said to me, you know, I think there's this type of therapy I think that you will like to practice. Based on the conversations we had had about what exactly I wanted to do, she's like, I think you take this 8-hour training course, and then and tell me what you think. So I took it. It was on acceptance and commitment therapy. And I was like, this is amazing. This is the best thing I've ever seen. But what's really cool with that is that I actually have used a lot of those techniques on myself to see how well they work. And a lot of them work really well. And I was like, this is actually, again, making me feel even better.
Yeah, that's actually brings up a good question that I recently saw a video from Jessica, who's a previous guest I've had on, who's a psychologist. But basically the idea is, does life experience outweigh, you know, going through school and learning about how to help people with that experience, in this case, like mental health? In your case, you have the benefit of both having the life experience and also going through the training and getting, you know, the school side of it. In your opinion, do you think one maybe has more sway than the other, or do you think they balance each other out?
That's really interesting. I think depending on what you're doing, I think they're really both important. Like obviously if you're going to be like a therapist, like I am, you have to go to school, you have to get that knowledge. So you need that. And that's really, really important because there are things that, you know, giving advice to your family and friends is very different from leading someone through the therapeutic process. But definitely my life experience informs what I do a lot and kind of helped me figure out which type of therapy to practice or which, you know, types of therapies to incorporate. And also really helps me connect with my clients because I always self-disclose when I have a chronic illness client that I also have a chronic illness. So I understand to a degree what they're going through. Everybody's totally individual and different, but you know, at least I can see where they're coming from, which really, really helps us bond and makes it therapy, I think, just works so much better when you have a good therapeutic relationship.
So yeah, definitely.
They're important.
So have you ever run into any of your colleagues where maybe they see an issue differently than you, where maybe you say, you know, but look, I've experienced this. And in this case, this is why it helped me and maybe it would help your patient. Have you ever had that kind of a difference of opinion?
I think what I've found so far is that everybody's really willing to collaborate and we all know that we have different experiences. So I, for example, when I was in my practicum, I had two supervisors actually, because one only worked part-time. So, and neither of my supervisors specialized in chronic pain or chronic illness, but the where I was doing my practicum, they were really great and they would give me all those cases. So, but as we're doing it, sometimes they would have a chronic illness client or they'd be trying to help me with one of my clients. And they would definitely be coming from different perspectives. And we did have some really interesting conversations about, you know, my life experience. And they were actually the ones who told me that you should self-disclose to these clients because it will help. But they also, you know, sometimes they say like, oh, like I think like this. And then I would be like, no, yeah, I see that, but I was kind of thinking this. And then, you know, sometimes there's a happy medium or sometimes they were totally right. And I'd go with their opinion. But often they were like, no, like that kind of life experience does seem to outweigh when you have those conversations. And again, if people are really open to them, and I find other counselors particularly to be open to different points of view.
Yeah, I'm glad that they were open to it, because I feel like coming up as like them being your supervisors and having that background already in their training, but then you having those life experiences, I feel like it would be a little bit of a challenge for you to push back with just life experience and maybe them shoot that down right away. But it sounds like they're really receptive to what you experienced. And I feel like that's the best case that you could have had whenever you're coming up and learning about everything.
Yeah, totally. I really lucked out with where I did my practicum and my two supervisors were amazing.
Awesome. So how does ACT and CBT therapies relate to yourself and your clients? And what are those for everybody listening, myself included?
Yeah, so CBT, so that's cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's the most studied type of therapy and it's the most practiced type of therapy in the world. So with CBT, you're really looking at people's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, right, to help them manage their mental health better. And it's been around for a long time. So it's based on both behavioral science and then cognitive science, kind of became one right after the other. And yeah, like I said, it's been widely studied. It's got a lot of evidence supporting that it's helpful. And it's, I mean, that's the type of therapy when I went to therapy that I got was this cognitive behavioral therapy that was kind of infused with mindfulness, which I find to be very helpful for me anyway, and for most people, what I've
Yeah.
seen. But so that's what CBT is. And then ACT, or we actually call it ACT for short, so that it's acceptance and commitment therapy. And it's what we call a third wave cognitive behavioral therapy. So it's like CBT in that we are dealing with thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, but there's an added emphasis on kind of this life meaning or values component, which really stems from existential therapy and existentialism. And then there is this very experiential element to it. So when clients come to session with me, we do the talk portion for about half the session. And then the last half of the session, we do like a very experiential component where I teach them a skill and then we do the skill together and then we debrief the skill. And sometimes we've also incorporated skills while we've been talking. So it's kind of, there's a lot of doing. And
Okay.
that's tends to be particularly helpful for people because we're trying to basically you're trying to rewire someone's brain when you're in therapy.
Yeah. So, one thing that I feel like would be hard, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're listening to somebody who is going through a situation very similar to yourself, since you specialize in that area, if you hear them saying, I can't find any answers, and I've been to this and this place and tried this and that, but haven't ha had any success, and you know that there's this other thing that they haven't tried, do you have to hold yourself back from giving that, almost medical advice or pointing them in a certain direction because there's those boundaries you can't cross? Or have you been able to kind of still work with them to get them the help that they need that maybe they don't know would help them?
Yeah, I think that a lot of it can come just through conversation. So therapists are not supposed to give advice in general because at the end of the day, most people don't follow advice, right? You have to want to change from within. So, but I think that what I found is that having a conversation, oh, what have you tried? Oh, like, did you know about these other things that exist out there? Have you tried them? And then let the client pick and choose themselves because at the end of the day, I might think something would be super helpful, but if it's not my area of expertise, then, for example, nutrition. I know that following an anti-inflammatory diet is really helpful for people with autoimmune diseases. And it's actually helpful for depression, because your brain basically is slightly inflamed when you're depressed. And so I know that following an anti-inflammatory diet would be very helpful. However, I'm not a nutritionist or a dietitian. I can't really give that kind of advice. So I kind of point people in the right direction. I give them like the psychoeducation about it. So just basically, like I just said, like this is what we know, this is what their science says. If you'd like me to find your referral for someone who can help you with that, or if you would like to know the name of a book that I can recommend to you, and then I kind of let the client go from there.
Awesome. So how do you balance your own health and your client's health when they're kind of dependent on you in a certain way to, help them when they're feeling low or, really needing it? And, work in general, like how do you actually find that balance now?
Yeah, it's really important like as a healthcare professional to look after yourself. And this is a lot of you hear a lot of like healthcare professionals burn out or struggle with things like compassion fatigue, and that's really common. And what I found is that if I just really focus on my own self-care, then I can always be there for my clients. So, if I do some sessions online, so if I'm working from home, I like usually have a heating pad right near me so I can use it if I need to. I meditate every day. I do yoga 4 to 5 times a week. I exercise regularly. The things that I know will just help me in general allow me to be there for my clients when I need to be there.
Awesome. So, do you actually find yourself fighting being known as the sick person, or even being labeled in some way, or has it not really been an issue for you in your own experience? Because I know a lot of people, even myself, whenever I was younger, I had a lot of health problems, and I didn't really want to be, known as the sick person, even though I always had to miss school and go to the doctor's appointments and that kind of thing. Have you had a similar situation?
No, I haven't really. I mean, I guess it's totally possible that other people maybe think of me that way, but I certainly don't think of myself that way. And I think that's really important. If we don't think of ourselves, we tend to attach labels to ourselves, especially when we have a diagnosis. So if we think of ourselves, this is part of the reason I don't like the term spoonie, because if I just think of myself as being a spoonie or I think of myself as having a chronic illness, is that really improving my life? Like, does it make me feel good? Does it, or does it kind of make me feel anxious or depressed? Right. And I think it's different for everybody, but I really think people need to take a moment and just like, is this label serving me in a really good way? Or is it kind of hindering me? The same thing happens with mental health diagnoses a lot. Is what I see is like people will really over identify with being, you know, a depressed person or an anxious person. Like I even have friends like that. And it's like, okay, that's yes, you have some anxiety or you know, maybe you're suffering from depression right now, but that's not who you are. And so I think if you can make that distinction for yourself as like, I maybe have these things and they're maybe a part of me, but they're not who I am. I never ever identify as being a sick person. So I don't really see why anybody else would identify me that way.
One of the things that kind of leads into that is, other people's perceptions. Have you ever had a really good day where you feel like you can just conquer the world? And maybe you feel a little bit hesitant to actually go out and openly enjoy the day because the perception people might have. If you got out of a car out of that, handicapped spot, and then you go for, a run because you're feeling so great, does that kind of make you think like maybe they think that I'm not sick or have a different look towards, maybe people in general being handicapped?
Yeah, I think that definitely can happen. I think I felt more like that closer to the beginning. Like, yeah, it was kind of weird. Like, if I could go for a hike, you know, on a day versus like the next, the other day, I couldn't, I had to miss work, right? So that definitely comes up. I feel less like that now. Again, just based on where I'm at, you know, mentally, emotionally, physically. We're going to have good days and bad days. I think pacing is really important. So what tends to happen when people have a really good day is that then they overdo it and then they have a really crappy day like for a week. Like, so I think that if you are going to maybe do a little more one day, and I've totally done, I did this a couple weeks ago. I went for like a 2-hour hike, which was way past my limit. And the next day I didn't want to do anything, but I actually forced myself to do some of what I normally do. Not everything, because I knew everything. I couldn't do everything, but some of it so that I could work my way back up, and not, you know, miss a whole week basically. It still took me about a week to recover, but at least I was doing stuff along. It probably would have taken me longer if I hadn't done anything. But I think just to like to go back to your question, like I wasn't as concerned with what other people think at this point.
Yeah, and I feel like maybe a easy way to relate it to people is I'm almost certain that everybody's called in or been sick one day. And they want to post something that's really funny that they saw, or they want to post, this really good meal that they had, but then they're like, I can't because everybody's going to see from work and they're going to know that I'm not really, as sick as I said I was. Even though they really are sick, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like everybody's probably had a time in their life where they maybe thought, I better not post this right now because I called in today.
Yeah, totally. And that's totally normal, right? And so yeah, sometimes you won't post it and sometimes maybe it doesn't matter.
One of the things I found in really interesting was that you're a writer, and has that been an outlet for you where you could put your thoughts out and into words and maybe release some stress that you have?
Yeah, so I started a blog not long, maybe like a year after I was diagnosed. And I initially used it like as like an online journal. Like it was like me and my thoughts about having a chronic illness. And then I actually eventually transitioned it to be more like educational, like I'm going to include my life experience, but also like maybe like let's explore together these alternative ways of living and improving our lives. So it is like a great release, but also I've always found it, especially the educational component, helpful because then I'm also learning things about like, oh, I could try this or I didn't think of that or you know I've been trying this and it seems to be working so I want to share it with other people.
Has
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, has it been helpful for you to be able to look back and say, okay, I made note of this and this is exactly what I did back then, rather than just being like, I really can't remember exactly what I did, but I think I went to this place or I think I tried that, to actually have it written down to where you can fall back and say, I tried this and this didn't work, or rather than just kind of guessing.
I definitely think it's helpful. Or like I had my naturopath now suggested, a treatment that to me that I actually had before, and I had actually blogged about it before, and so I did remember that. I was like, no, you know what, that one was, it was okay, but it, I don't think it was as effective as it, some of this other stuff. So it is nice to have that written document that I can access whenever.
So were you hesitant to put out so much personal information, about your divorce, your illnesses, your, maybe work struggles? And if you were, what pushed you to actually go through with it?
I wasn't, I don't think I really thought too much about it at first, giving out this information. I actually thought about it more later when I decided to go into the mental health field. I'm like, how much of this information should actually be out there? But I also really believe in authenticity, and I think it's important to be authentic, and I think it's helpful for other people. And really, my goal was to help other people. So whether that was through the blog, or going into this particular field, I want to help other people. And sometimes hearing people's personal stories is extremely helpful for other people because they know that they're not alone. And so that was, I guess, that knowing that outweighs any hesitancies that I've had.
Yeah, and speaking of helping people, you are writing a self-help book. How do you hope that it impacts people, and like, what would you want the reader to know once you put that book out there for the world?
Yeah, so the book I'm working on is currently titled The Single Lady's Guide to Chronic Pain. So it's, really what I'm hoping is that I can give people, again, some of that personal story information, right, to kind of know where, how this has helped me. But also, I want to give them some tangible things that maybe they can try to help themselves as well. And the book is meant to be like a supplement to. It's not a replacement for going to like therapy. Like, I think that's more helpful, right? But this is like a lot of like, have you explored psychoeducation? Have you explored, did you know that exercise is really helpful for chronic pain? And this is kind of why it's, how it's helpful, why it's helpful, how it's helped me, and then some like, mindfulness techniques kind of thrown in throughout, like, let's do this little exercise together and, really develop some of our mindfulness skills because they're really helpful. So it's, I'm really just hoping people can use it to really improve their life, even if it's just a little bit, right? Like a little bit is better than nothing. I tell people this all the time. Like change is really slow. So if you're changing a little bit every, even couple weeks or every month or two, like that's better than nothing. So you gotta be very patient with yourself. And yeah, so that's kind of what I'm hoping for.
So we've talked about the challenges from having chronic pain illnesses. What benefits have there been? And have you found any, coal under pressure into diamond moments? Like, have you really brought yourself out to even be better than you were before because of the struggle?
Yeah, I actually think I'm a way better person than I was before. It's so funny. I mean, first of all, like the career change would probably not have happened if I hadn't had a chronic illness. Like I just, though I always possessed some of that, that compassion and empathy and the things that you need to be a therapist, I never really saw myself going in that direction. So that wouldn't have happened. But also like that whole personal growth journey, I think was really just inspired by having a chronic illness. I was like, well, what else, what else can I do to better my life or be the person that I want to be? I think is really what it came down to, and kind of connecting with what my values and what was important to me. And I really don't, I mean, I'm not saying that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't had a chronic illness, but it certainly was the inspiration for that happening.
So before we wrap up, I just wanted to say I appreciate you taking the time to talk about your own experience, whether that's your personal, your work, or just your opinions on different things. And again, I've really been looking forward to talking to you. I know we had to, hold off a little bit, and I think I mentioned to you that, my mom is one of those people that has a chronic illness where, you don't really know. And whenever we had to kind of push this interview back, I thought, you know, that's fine. Like, I totally get it. Like, there's like, you can't help it. Like, it's just things in your life control some things that you don't have any say over. So I appreciate that you were willing to come and talk to everybody about this, because I feel like it's a really important thing that not everybody really has maybe a perspective on, because they don't really see it all the time. And the people that do have that perspective, maybe they feel like they can't really ask somebody who's sick, hey, what's it like every day for you for the last, you know, 10 years? So for you to kind of open up and shed some light on that topic, I feel like that's really valuable to a lot of people.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on. Like, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to people, and I hope that, you know, your listeners found this really helpful and beneficial for them.
Yeah, I believe it is. Like I said, you really touched on a lot of topics, and you're authentic, like you were saying. Like, you can tell that you just, you know, everything that you've been through is who you are. It's not, you know, scripted. It's not something that you kind of put a front up for. So I appreciate that. And, you know, one of the things I try to do is just kind of bring a little bit of gray area into like the black and white perspectives. So for you to kind of walk that line and really show everybody kind of all sides of it, I love that.
Yeah, I love that you want to do that and show that gray area, because I really think most of life is a gray area, right?
For sure. The older I get, the more I realize it.
Yeah.
Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I really hope that, you know, if any listener who's has a chronic illness or has chronic pain and you're struggling right now, know that, you know, there are avenues for you to seek, you know, a better life. But change is really slow. So, you know, be really patient with yourself on your own journey.
So, where can people follow you or follow your progress, especially once your book comes out? Where can people go?
So, I have a blog. So it's chronically-living.com. Sorry, chronically-living.com. And so you'll find my blog posts. I will definitely keep my readers up to date with the book status. I might be launching a new podcast. I'm just working on the details of that. So that will also be posted on there. And then I have an Instagram account. So it's chronically.living_.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, and I hope that you have a great rest of the day.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for sticking around for the episode. And if you enjoyed this one, feel free to check out the other topics that I've covered with other guests. And if you want to support this podcast, there's a link in the description. Scroll all the way down, a little bit further, right there. Scroll a little bit up right there. It says support this podcast. If you do that, if you click that link, it actually lets you support this podcast. I know, funny, right? Coincidence. If you click that, it'll walk you through the steps, and whatever you can give, whether it's 1 cent, $1, $5, $1 million, $10, you know, whatever, it's 100% more than it had before, and it all goes towards a podcast. So please, if you want to help, feel free. If you can't, well, that's okay too. We'll be friends. No problem. See you next time, guys.